Welcome to a new episode of Outside the Panels with your host, Johnny the Machine Hughes.
Welcome, everyone, to a new episode of Outside the Panels. I am your host. I'm your host, as always, Johnny the Machine Hughes. And joining me from stateside, hooray for Hollywood, is Mr. Owen Hammer, writer extraordinaire.
Did you say Johnny the Machine Hughes?
Johnny the Machine Hughes, that's me.
Is that a reference to Glenn Gary, Glenn Ross, or is that just your own thing?
It's because I'm like clockwork. It's because we get reviews done.
They call me the Hammer, but then I'm told it doesn't really qualify as a nickname.
Well, it depends. It depends what you're doing to get the nickname.
Yes, there we go. Well, I'll tell you how I got the nickname, because the Hammer builds it up. And the hammer breaks down.
All right. So if it was just like knocking nails into wood, I'd be like, yeah, that's not a good nickname.
No, that would be a terrible nickname. Perhaps that's why I get out of the profession.
Indeed. Out of the nickname present. To be fair, I didn't get... Al, the guy who runs UCPN and Comic Crusaders, he gave me my nickname.
Okay.
And I hated it. I've got to be honest. I absolutely hated it for ages. But it's kind of stuck around, so, you know.
Is he trying to get a Silver Age vibe? Because, you know, Silver Age Marvel, everybody had a nickname like Stan the Manly and Sturdy Steve Ditko.
I don't know, but ironically, I do like Machine Man from the
There you go.
It kind of works. You know, I'm all right with that. Okay, so we're here. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule. We're here to talk about your book, Von Bach.
Yes.
Right?
Yes, I'm sorry. You blanked out in that question.
Did I pronounce Von Bach correct?
That is correct. Von Bach. Some people go Von Bach to be particularly Prussian, but Von Bach is what people say.
Excellent. Excellent. So, for people who aren't aware of what this book is all about, give us the skinny. What's going on? What makes it interesting?
Von Bach is about an undead monster who sues a movie studio for defamation for making a horror movie about him. It's a parody of popular culture and celebrity culture, and if you like classic horror films, you will definitely love this book. And if you don't like horror films, you will still like it, because, like I said, it's a broader satire of society. So this guy, Von Bach, who's kind of like Frankenstein's monster or Dr. Frankenstein, he's a guy who was killed in the 19th century and brought back to life with his own machine. And cut to the present in Hollywood, and he comes back to life a second time to find out that he is a celebrity because his lover, who's based on Mary Shelley, wrote the whole story, and everybody just assumed it was fiction because it's a story about a guy coming back from the dead. And now Von Bach is a household name like Frankenstein or Dracula, and he is mortified in every sense of the word. At Worldwide Pictures, based on Universal, they are making the 100th Von Bach film, which is not an exaggeration. There are over 100 films featuring Frankenstein's monster and over 100 films featuring Dracula. So he sues them, and a lot of humor comes from the fact that the tone is this creepy gothic horror, but it's about the boring and mundane aspects of filing a lawsuit. and that's a stand-in for intellectual property law, which is so complicated, but it's about the ownership of ideas, which is such a grand idea. And also a lot of humor comes from the fact that even though Von Bach is undead, he's kind of the straight man. He's kind of just an ordinary guy. These high-strung show business people are the real weirdos in Von Bach.
As I say, hooray for Hollywood. All right, yeah. So lots of things going on in this book. It's a really good, fun read. I enjoyed looking through the issues. What got you into comics?
Oh, I've been a comic book reader for years and years and years, and I've been writing TV, film, web series, and then I got into plays because a theater company wanted me to write for them. As you know, or as maybe you don't know, Von Bach was a play in 2010 to 2013. And I've thought about making it into a movie, but fundraising, which I'll talk about later if you want to hear about it, went nowhere. I've always thought about writing a comic book just because I'm a huge Scott McCloud fan and I understand the medium pretty well, and I've thought about just giving it a shot. The opportunity to collaborate with Mariano and Hernan, the artists, came about, and an agent at a comic book artist and writer agency told me I should just put it up on Kickstarter, see if I can get the funding. I got the funding for the first issue, and now I'm flying by the seat of my pants, trying to get all seven issues out. I'll tell you one thing about writing for comic books, though. I had adapted the play into a screenplay, obviously. And then adapting the screenplay into a graphic novel ended up being about 100 times more complicated than I could ever have imagined. There are things like you have to have some kind of act break at the end of every page. You got to have like a little button there. You can't just have arbitrary, like, this little bit will be 50 seconds, this little bit will be 20 seconds. Like, the last thing on the page has to be something to make you turn the page. And then and then once I broke it up into chapters, I had to break it up into 20-page increments. And then I had to kind of rearrange stuff so there's, like, a real suspenseful act break at every 20 pages. And then just putting things into panels. A lot of gags that work on stage and on film can't possibly work in a comic book.
But vice versa. You know, it's give and take.
Yes. Actually, there's a lot of very funny gags that came about in the process of making the comic book that I would never even have conceived of because it wouldn't have worked on stage or in a film. I'm a published comic book writer. Hooray for me.
You're like the Aaron Sorkin of the comic book world. If anyone doesn't get the reference, Aaron Sorkin wrote A Few Good Men, which was a stage play before it became a movie, before I went on to whatever, a sports show, I can't remember the name of. But of course, The West Wing and Studio 60.
The graphic novel had artwork by Rob Liefeld. I think that was a bad choice. That's probably why it didn't do so well.
No comment. I refuse to. You know what? I think that's a bit of a disservice. I think Liefeld was very much of his time. He's very opinionated, and that's fine.
Poor Johnny. Johnny, can you at least can we all agree that him drawing A Few Good Men would at least be a mistake? Can we agree on that?
Yeah.
Can I get one joke in without getting tangled up?
Okay. So Liefeld, don't draw A Few Good Men. Stay the hell away from The West Wing. Thanks, Jesus. Right. But can you imagine? McFarlane on The West Wing with the capes as jackets.
Yes, actually, McFarlane would be a better choice because, God, what are the three people who even understand this reference? That the character puts his jacket on in a weird way, like the way that McFarlane draws capes, that would be perfect. Yeah.
That'd be brilliant. Yeah, he does the whole like the thing, doesn't he? Yeah, when he makes his decision, bless him. I'm a huge West Wing fan.
West Wing fan.
All right. So you said that part of the story for Von Bach is about ownership. Now, probably the biggest ownership idea, sort of argument, discussion that's around in comic books will always be Jack Kirby.
Yeah.
Do you fall on any particular side, or do you think that it was a collab of both?
Oh, I don't fall on a side in the sense that I was not in the room where it happened. I don't know who made up what. What happened? People who say that Jack Kirby or Steve Ditko, they did all the work, are ignoring the fact that when they draw something and Stan Lee doesn't write it, it's significantly different, and I would say usually worse. But when Stan Lee writes something and doesn't have one of the great artists working on it, it's not that good either, which makes me think that it is a collaboration. The discussion of who got ripped off, if anybody, I don't know, because like I said, I wasn't there. The most controversial opinion I have is that I like Steve Ditko better than Jack Kirby, but
I think you know what, I am on that hill with you, because I think As in Ditko Spider-Man is by far better than Kirby's Fantastic Four.
One person who doesn't get any credit for artist rights is Marv Wolfman. Apparently, when he sued over Blade, he opened up the floodgates, even though he lost that lawsuit. Apparently, he was responsible for a lot of artists getting not only getting credit, but getting some money for adaptations of their work.
Mm. Yeah, the whole Blade thing, that's an interesting one. So, is Kirby and Stan, is that your, and Ditko, is that your comic sort of like vibe? Are you still in the comics nowadays? Are you still buying books?
I like Marvel Silver Age, but I like Dan Klaus and Adrian Tomine and Jessica Abel, and I like the independent stuff, autobiographical stuff. Mm-hmm. Von Bock definitely comes out of the discipline of doing non-superhero stories in comic books, non-superhero stories that don't make for good prose or don't make for good films, because there's some little like fantastic element to it. Mm-hmm. That it's not 100 fantastic elements. There's not like a thunder god and a man with spider powers and a princess and all that stuff coming out. There's just this one guy who came back from the dead. And now let's unpack that. And like Dan Klaus had his graphic novel called Death Ray, where this kid has literally a death ray. And then that's it. And then the whole story is just unpacking what would happen if a kid had this.
Had a death ray.
And I like that artwork a lot better. I like clean artwork for the most part. As you can see, Mariano and Hernan are fantastic. Not only is it's got that like clean vibe of the underground, but the independent artists, but
yeah,
coloring is so exciting. It evokes like really exciting superhero stories, but it's not like so vibrant that it looks like Mobius or heavy metal recolored stuff from the 80s or something like that.
Mm. But, I mean, the artwork's great. It has very much a, how can I put this? It has very much a cartoony style of comic book. It's kind of not caricature, but it kind of lends itself well to that extension. So for example, the stoner dude who's in the pyrotechnics, he looks like, if you think of stoner dude, it's like that's actually like it's drawn the way it should be drawn. It's in
chubby faces. Stoner dude, which character are we talking about?
Book two, the guy that's in the pyrotechnics, his mate Barry the special effects guy.
Oh, yes. That guy looked like, because you know I work in visual effects. I'm a visual effects artist during the day. And that guy looks like every controlling for like white males that is of that age. That is every visual effects artist I've ever seen in my entire life. Yes, it is. That is exactly, except for the fact that his monitors are way too big. That is what it looks like in a visual effects bay.
Okay, cool.
Instead of reason, we needed his monitors to be giant, like it is most of the time. But yeah, he's just like sweaty and pale and has like a undershirt. And I notice he has this male pattern baldness that I don't think I've seen on any real human being in my life. Mariano and Hernan are perfect for that. Like, I'll just give them like a broad stroke of what a character should look like. And like, boom, there they are.
Cool. Excellent. So are there any other characters in the books that kind of based on your experiences within TV land? Or can you not say for legal reasons?
Everybody is so different than who they're supposed to be that I'm good. In issue three, there's a character and I just kind of said he's like a Peter Cushing type. And I look at the artwork and it's Peter Cushing. Mariano just drew Peter Cushing, and I hopefully I won't get sued. I think because it's a parody of Peter Cushing, I can get away with it. But I was like, wow. And the funny thing is, if you look at the original film, this is supposed to be a parody of the Hammer horror films, no relation. Curse of Frankenstein. There's 100 films where Peter Cushing is Dr. Frankenstein or Van Helsing. He's the foil, or he's the guy who fights the mummy. And that's why the mummy's always been a second tier monster, because there's no official enemy to the mummy.
Okay.
But I the costume designer, I told her to make the costume look like the outfit that Christopher Lee has in Curse of Frankenstein when he plays Frankenstein's monster. And she found that exact costume somehow. So now in the film, he is Christopher Lee as Frankenstein's monster. Like, I don't even know if it counts as a parody anymore.
It's real life. No, it's art imitating art imitating art.
Yes, it is. If people are wondering, the covered issue one behind you, thank you for putting that up, by the way. I did not prepare as such.
But I had to look at the covers that were available, and I like this one the best. So.
Yeah. I do like that artwork, and I love Mariano and Hernandez. I love their characters. For one thing, they can draw faces. It's amazing how many professional comic book artists can't draw different faces and then draw the same face over and over again, especially women. If you look for our viewers over Johnny's screen right shoulder, there's the main character, Mina. One of the worst things about Mina is that because she has red hair, it's kind of hard to tell that she's supposed to be Asian. But Mariana knows how to draw an Asian woman, so that kind of worked out for me. Good. But in close-ups where you can't see their hair, their costume, you still know who the character is, and their expressions are fantastic.
I agree wholeheartedly. The amount of books I see where characters just have like wooden faces.
Yeah.
It really, fair enough. Artists can draw, especially superhero artists, can draw the powerful pose and everything, and they can get that right. But it's like sometimes you want the nuanced bit, you want the emotion bit, you want.
Yes.
And there's some really good artists out there who just haven't managed to put life into the eyes.
Yeah.
And I say this, and people go, "Really? It's a picture?" I'm like, "Yeah, but." I would show them this and say, look how alive Mina looks. Look how alive she is. Her face is engaged. She's smiling. You can see the teeth. Her eyes are different shapes because she's smiling. You know, that's observational art at its best.
Yes. I love this cover. Over your left shoulder is Von Bock.
I'll move out of the way so everyone can see. There you go.
Yeah. Okay, so the mad scientist, well, actually, he's not a mad scientist. He's a very reasonable guy who just stumbled in some bad luck and built a resurrection machine. So that in the 19th century, Dr. Von Bock is enthusiastic about his inventions, and he's very excited. And Mina in present day is enthusiastic about making a movie. She's the main character is the writer of the new Von Bock film, and she's kind of torn between her professional commitment, her personal commitment, and her growing attraction to Von Bock, who I assume it's a strictly platonic attraction, of course, but he's basically just a deformed monster by the time he makes it to 2013. And you'll notice they both have this incredible enthusiasm for what they're doing, and as you might have guessed, both of their plans go very bad.
Shh, don't give the game away. Don't give the game away.
Now,
all right, so good.
I don't think.
Sorry?
The number of movies where everybody's excited and then it turns in, because I work on movies, and then like everyone's really excited, and then not only is the experience terrible, but the movie is terrible. It just kind of puts me in the mind of like the mad scientist who's like, this will benefit humanity, and like, oh no, I made a monster.
Like Green Lantern movie. All right, okay, on that note,
Lantern and you made that joke, or was that just an incredible coincidence?
Just an incredible coincidence.
Okay. Hi, guys. I love you.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. While we're back, we'll continue talking more Von Bock. All right. Okay. Whilst we're on the break, go and listen to this advert for the up and coming virtual con through Comic Crusaders. Listen to the message and check out the times. All right. Make sure you take part. All right. Here's the ad.
You know, you always hear those stories of people going through cancer, and you think, that's never going to happen to me. I can remember that night when I got that call. It's about as vivid as my son being born. That's when I'm told your mom has leukemia. And I just drop. Didn't know what to think or feel. I just felt numb and drop.
Comic Crusaders presents Virtual Con 2.
only on ComicCrusaders.com.
Welcome back to Outside the Panels with me, Johnny the Machine Hughes, talking with Owen Hammer, not related to the Hammer House of Horror.
Which no relation. No, I've thought about lying about it, but you know, there's people who research that stuff. But, yeah, like I said, the Hammer films do play into the story just a little bit. And by the way, the film segments that we shot for the play was like 10% shot on film. I forgot to mention that. The film segments that made it into the comic book, the theater company's given me permission to put them on the Hammer Comics website. So if you go to the Von Bock page, you can actually see some of the films from the book exist as actual films, and you can see them. That's Hammer-Comics. .com. The guy who owns Hammer Comics without the dash, I'm coming for you.
The hammer's coming down. Oh, man. To be fair, I love that design choice through the book, because you're flicking through the book and then you get like the film strip. It's such a clever way of giving relevance to what's going on, because otherwise it's just a bunch of characters, isn't it? So, well, was that your choice, or was that Mariano's on that one?
That goes way, way back to the initial concept of Von Bock. First of all, because the Von Bock is like a household word and the characters know who he is, but the reader doesn't, if somebody says, that's just like that scene from the 1920 film, then the page will turn into that scene, and you'll actually see that film clip. In the play, when the characters are talking and they reference it, the lights go out, and it just cuts to that film clip. We actually went out and shot it on digital video. And in fact, the director of photography for the film clips, Aaron Moorhead, has become a huge horror director now. And you should check out all of his films. They're fantastic. I'd like to say I gave him his start, but that would be a lie. That was serendipity. But what he did was he said, because you know, sometimes people try to make films look old. They make it black and white and put grain on it. Aaron actually studied the cinematography, and with cheap fluorescent lights, he copied what it would look like to a new digital film camera that has higher sensitivity, and we really did a great job of copying all the look and feel of those old films. And there on the website, you can see them. And if you read the book and you think one of the film parodies is funny, you can then go and see the actual film of that. Cool. So. And that's for free.
So that's like its own cross-multimedia thing going on there.
Well, one of the reasons why the next arena, that's the theater company, one of the reasons why they picked my project was they really wanted to do something with multimedia. Mm-hmm. And this was made for multimedia. And I'm a big Weird Al Yankovic fan. And making these little parodies just was very appealing to me. And I directed half of them. And I was lucky to have this incredible cast and crew, so much so that I don't think I deserve them. Some of them have gone on to stardom, as a matter of fact. But I'll let you pick them out if you can find them.
But well, that's a
like I said, the director of photography is now a quite accomplished director of photography for horror films, and actor too. And the movie The Endless, he not only wrote and directed it with his partner Justin Benson, but they star in it as well.
All right, so, okay.
Incredible luck. So check very those cool. out.
So let me ask you a question, because you're down on this book as a writer for the book.
Mm-hmm.
You have visual tendencies because your day job is visual effects and visual stuff for TV.
Right.
I'm always interested in people who think visually, how they manage to put the words on paper. Because for me, I can either do one, or I can do the other. I can't do both. So do you become a bit of a takeover, Ted, when you're sort of like giving out the scripts to the guys for the art?
Is that what you call it in Britain?
What, takeover, Ted? Yeah, like someone who's like...
We'll have to adopt that.
Yeah, go for it.
Well, in screenwriting class in college, they would always say, as a writer, you have to make your script director-proof. Which means that everything that needs to be done is there, and there's no ambiguity. There's no way they could screw it up. So I think about things like somebody comes into the room because they have to be in the room, and I say, well, that's not enough. What are they wearing? Why are they wearing it on that day? What's their hair look like? Are they frustrated? Let's make their hair frazzled. Is there some sort? Do they have some sort of superiority complex? Let's have bright lights behind them, and so they're like a silhouette and things like that. And then I write it in very simple, concrete terms. And whether it's a screenplay or comic book script, the writers, or not the writers, I'm the writer, good Lord, the artists, the actors, the production designer, they have stuff to work with. The key to being a writer that people want to work with is that when you write a description of something, you're giving a gift to whoever has to execute that. If you go into too much detail or too little detail, that doesn't help them. But if you give them something that is just concrete enough that they know what to do, but abstract enough that they have the freedom to do it, then they love you. And then the flip side of that is then you have to surround yourself with people who you trust to execute your vision. And I think it's more luck than some sort of talent, that I've always been surrounded by talented people, but in the films and in the comic book, that's worked out.
I think by the sounds of it, I think you do yourself a massive disservice. I think the fact that you're putting all this effort in is why people gravitate to yourself and to writers like you who put that effort in. I think gone are the days of the Marvel method of writing, yeah, where someone just puts Spider-Man and the Green Goblin have a fight. Yeah. There you go. Off you go. You know, it very much, I think, especially with comics, I think the audience has matured now to a point where it's people like me that are buying comics, mm-hmm, not 10 through 14-year-olds, you know? So yeah, when we look at a comic book, whether it be Batman, whether it be an independent book, whether it be Marvel, we're looking for that. Obviously not massive amount of maturity in superhero books because it's a superhero's book, but we're looking for that hook that gets us, you know, that thing that says this isn't just a run of the mill, yet another episode of Batman versus the Joker, something else, you know? And I think if you're working on an independent book, that's great because you've got that creativity to do what you want to do. But the flip of that is you don't have the IP to drag people in straight away.
Yes. You don't have to tell me how hard it is to readers. I do have an advantage in that all these horror tropes are well known. But this is a funny book called Frankenstein, or a funny book called Dracula. It's a funny book called Von Bock. But a lot of people who are interested in the book see the cover and see... Usually I make fun of some kind of horror movie, movie poster on the cover, and that draws in a lot of people. But starting your own thing is hard. That's why so few people do it. That's why, like, for example, the Lost in Space TV show, it's very good.
I love that show.
But the old show from the 60s, I think, is just dumb. And somebody at Netflix said, if we do the cool space family show, it's going to be hard to attract viewers, but if we call it Lost in Space, then we'll attract viewers. And it's unfortunate, but the people who are out looking for stuff are the people that you want to find your stuff anyway. So once you get that audience, it's a great group of people to sort of have. It's good to have their attention because they're paying attention and you know that they're enjoying it.
Well, I like the old 60s Lost in Space stuff. That first season, super serious until space carrots happen, and then it goes all a bit bonkers, admittedly, but, you know, it's cool. Is Frankenstein, I've got to ask, is Frankenstein, because obviously that's the most comparative alliteration with Von Bock, is he your favorite monster of all time? Is he your favorite universal monster? Or?
I've always been fascinated, even as a little kid. I actually watched... I think every Frankenstein movie ever made in prep 10 years ago before I finished writing the play. And they're not that good. The Universal ones, I mean, I can understand why they're appealing and why they were hits, but they're full of, I guess now they're cliches, but if you just kind of follow the story, it's like, this is kind of flat. The first two, directed by James Whales, are still very good and very important historically, but the sequels, they just get so ridiculous so fast.
Yeah.
If you keep track of how Frankenstein's monster dies in everyone, they have to keep coming up with a new way to kill him and then a new way for him to come back to life. And then this is true in Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, because Dr. Frankenstein eventually is dead, and we're moving through time, and he can't be alive anymore. And they have to keep coming up with an excuse for some guy to be the mad scientist who brings him back to life. And in Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman, it's Dr. Frankenstein's grandniece's fiancé is the mad scientist. And in the first act, he's like, oh, well, Frankenstein's a monster. We sure wouldn't want to bring him back to life. And then in the third act, he's like, I think we'll bring him back to life. And there's this 180 switch that happens in every Frankenstein sequel. And that's the sort of weirdness that I've tried to get to in my film parodies. Okay. But one thing that's fascinating is how the story of Frankenstein changes so dramatically from the novel to the famous movie to all the various adaptations. Mm. And then every 20 years or so, somebody is like, this isn't the guy with the bolts in his neck. This is Mary Shelley's original vision. And that's not the book either. And if you read the book, it's so far from any popular concept of Frankenstein's monster. And I'm fascinated by how stories change over time. And that's a big part of von Bock. That's a big part of I'm fascinated by how people who are religious think that the religious they're practicing, they say the religion I'm practicing today, this is just how my ancestors 10,000 years ago practiced this same religion. And like, no, it's not. It's absolutely not. And there's so many things that we think are timeless that we just invented like last week. And seeing how Frankenstein changes over time, you can definitely see that. For example, at the beginning of the 19th century to the end of the 19th century, fantasy and horror, we switched from magic to technology. And in the book, how does do you know this? Do you know how Dr. Frankenstein makes the monster?
I thought it was traditional electricity, zap him in, boom, that's it.
Well, was no electricity at the time. No, Dr. Frankenstein says magic, and then he uses magic, and then he has the monster, and there's like really no solid explanation. And at the end of the 19th century, people said, well, nobody's going to buy this story, so let's have it be electricity. And that's
there's a lightning storm somewhere. So my favorite Frankenstein interpretation. We're going a little bit off topic. Well, kind of, I guess. The Penny Dreadful one, you know, from the TV show.
I did watch it. Yes,
that's my favorite. The kind of tortured soul who kind of knows what he is.
Yeah.
Kind of my favorite. And I'll give you a bit of history. When my mum and dad went through a divorce when I was about 11, every Friday night, my mum would let us when once it split, my dad was somewhere else. My mum would let me and my brother stay up on a Friday night to watch the horror classics that were on.
Yeah.
So we watched things like Dracula and the first two Frankenstein movies. And we didn't get that far. My brother started getting scared, bless him,
because
he was younger. But generally, so I have a bit of a soft spot for those old black and whites.
I think you're about the same age as me, and that's the Gen X.
22.
What?
22, right?
Oh, no, you're not the same age as me. All right. No, Generation X, we saw it on UHF, and then the local TV station would – you'd get, like, all the Frankenstein movies. And then going up the dial, they would get the Hammer Frankenstein movies cheaper, and then going further up the dial, it would be these no-name horror knockoffs that I think really, like, screwed me up because – They were accidentally surreal, like the Croft TV shows, and that's I have amazing memories of those and hiding under the sheets. And Frankenstein's monster was just so scary to me.
That's what we've got Doctor Who for, hiding behind covers and stuff. all right, so we'll take a bit of a sidestep. You've worked on absolutely loads of TV, loads of movies. Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite, a one that you think to yourself, you know what, that was the best experience?
Well, working with James Cameron is always great, even though there's all these stories about how he's a nightmare to work with. I worked on three James Cameron films. Two of them were documentaries that aren't as well known, The Ghosts of the Abyss and Aliens of the Deep, and that's when I actually got to meet him. I have a degree from Weld University. I got to meet him and work with him, and then on Avatar, I never saw him. The crew was so huge, I was just lost. That was just exciting because I'm happy when things are organized and going well. Working on The Gifted, the TV show, was a lot of fun. The crew was very professional. Everything went smoothly. And everybody was very friendly. I won't mention any names, but I don't really run into problems where people are abusive to me. I run into problems where things are so disorganized that I kind of said, I'd rather that they just be organized and then just yell at me every day, because this is insufferable, the fact that, you know, people don't know what's going on.
No, I agree. That's exactly how I am at work. My day job has been a little bit chaotic recently. It's kind of thrown me for a loop because I like to be a little bit organized.
One film that was a lot of fun to work on that's kind of obscure is called Shoot 'Em Up with Clive Owen. Has he kind of is like the real life version of the video game character who just shoots everybody. Pretty fun and funny. And I would have to say that I got to go back. I didn't do a lot on it, but I had an amazing experience working on Spider-Man 2, just because that was such a well done film and so well conceived, because Dr. Octopus' arms were rod puppets in the close-ups and CGI in the wide shots.
Okay, cool.
I'd love to tell you that I was above the line and was part of the creative decision-making, but I was in charge of erasing all the rods on the rod puppet, which was tedious work, but my God, it looked great, and it looked great on my...
Cool, excellent. I will watch Spider-Man 2 with a cleaner eye now. I'll be like this.
That's Quantum, a good movie. Very underrated film. I'm not a big James Bond fan, but those new James Bond films are the only ones I could watch.
See, Quantum of Solace, I went to the pictures to see this, and I absolutely thought it was okay, because Casino Royale, the Daniel Craig one, blew my socks off. The thing that got me about Quantum of Solace is all through the film, the bad guy is shown as to be quite useless at fighting, and James Bond is shown to be absolutely kick-ass. But then at the end, at the final act, the bad guy nearly kills him in the fist fight. I'm like, come on, really? I've just watched 2 hours of them doing exactly the opposite. That was the only thing that bugged me about it, to be fair.
But, I thought of it that way. Well, I didn't write it, so.
Yeah. Dodge the bullet there. Dodge the bullet.
Yeah.
All right. Go
ahead. I realized I forgot to say Matt Nix. I was trying to remember his name, the executive producer of Gifted. Matt Nix, great guy to work for.
Cool. Excellent. So Gifted is kind of based on the mutants of X-Men, isn't it?
Yeah. Their connection to the X-Men films from 20th Century Fox is kind of purposely ambiguous, but it takes place in a X-Men universe and involves several X-Men characters, and they're kind of form their own like miniature second tier X-Men group.
Do you think, here's a question then for you before we get back to your book, do you think that the era, I know COVID's going to have an impact on this question, so do you think the era of superhero movies is over?
No, I think that people will always go to good films and superhero movies that just do the same thing over and over again are, you know, going to get boring. I think that Endgame was such an incredible accomplishment in filmmaking that I can't imagine what happens next in the Marvel universe. I'll work for them if they want to hire me, but like what happens because Endgame did correctly what Endgame did right, what 100 films before it did wrong. where the big scene at the end is actually interesting and integral to the story instead of just a headache-inducing mess of computer images. In fact, I wish I had worked on Endgame because that was, like I said, a fantastic movie. But
I'm not a Marvel fan. I'm a DC guy, right? Mm-hmm. So I said to my wife, because my wife loves Marvel and she loves Thor, because we look so alike. Mm-hmm. Not. and I said to her, right, we'll go and watch Endgame. Fine. And I knew it would be about time travel. And I knew it would do my head in. And I know there'd be loads of plot holes and stuff. And I said to her, as we went into the film, spoiler alert if you haven't seen it, I said, if this film ends and Cap is dancing with Peggy, mm-hmm. I'll be happy.
Yeah.
And that's it. That's all I want to happen. I'll sit through 3 hours of God knows what mm-hmm. to see Cap dance with Peggy.
That
was as good as Cap getting the hammer to me.
Yeah. But that's such a fantastic way to end this otherwise bananas film with hundreds of characters and superpowers and the fate of the universe at stake. And it's just this happy moment between these two people who honestly deserve to be happy. Yeah. So, fantastic film. Wish I wrote it.
Talking of writing, how did you get so much humor into Von Bach? Because I started reading it, and from pretty much the second panel in, there was gags or setups for gags. And these gags, they're not just there for living. They are genuinely very, very funny. Yeah. So I see a lot of comic books, and sometimes, because I see so many, sometimes nuances pass me by, and someone say, oh, but that's what this means. That I'm like, oh, yeah, okay, fair enough. But this hit me straight away. I spotted it, I saw it, I read it, I laughed, I smiled. How'd you manage to get so much humor into this?
Oh, well, I mean, that's just what I've spent my entire lifetime training myself to do. Writing humor, you've got to kind of get the plot to kind of crook and move towards something funny. But I would say the key is that the situation is funny. It's not a stock story with some jokes attached to it. And that was always the plan from the beginning, because I wanted it to be funny, but I didn't want it to be. I use the analogy of a Christmas tree. If you take a tree and you put a bunch of ornaments on it, that's a Christmas tree. But that's not how a story works. I think of a story as more of an organism. Everything's got to be in the right place or it's dead. Okay. And I just made sure. I just resisted the urge to go down left field towards a funny joke and kept coming up with funny ways to have the internally consistent plot reveal itself. And that's just something you've got to do when you're writing comedy. You can't have it be funny and then have a bunch of exposition and then go back to the jokes. And then you've just got to maintain the tone. And when things will get more serious in the upcoming chapters. And I think I do a good job of having the tone shift without it being too crazy. But I think that I've just trained myself to look and see what's funny about a situation. I'll give you an example. If you remember the Slap Chop, there's this guy who was selling a piece of rayon, called it the Sham Wow.
Okay.
And then later on, he had a Slap Chop where you would like put something that needs to be chopped and slap it, and it would chop it. Did these commercials get to Britain?
Nope.
Okay. Nope. But he shows you how easy it is to chop up some peanuts, and he goes, "You're gonna love my nuts." And put a pit in that. We're getting back to that. And then he slaps up some peanuts. They're about the size they would be at the ice cream store if you ask for peanuts. And he's like, "It would charge you 50 cents for that at the ice cream store." And if you think "You're gonna love my nuts" is funny, you might not be a good comedy writer. But if you think that they would charge you 50 cents for that is funny, because some guy is going to bring down the ice cream barons. He's going to go to the ice cream store and get a sundae and have his own nut chopping instrument that is going to undercut the cost of labor at the ice cream store. And he's going to say, "I've saved 50 cents. That situation to me is so absurd that like I would want to make that funny. You know, and and find it teasing out like the funny aspects of just finding the absurdity in things that a lot of people miss is a skill you need to be a comedy writer.
Well, I think laughing at nuts is pretty much a usual thing regardless of country, I think. So well done on that one.
That means the same thing in Britain, right?
Yeah.
Call them bollocks, whatever.
Yeah, we say bollocks, yeah.
Bollocks, a grave digger's biscuit. Sorry, that's a joke I stole from Community.
All right.
I'll see you at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, or as we call it in Britain, a grave digger's biscuit.
I'll let you have that one.
I'm sorry, it's occurring to me that wouldn't be funny to an actual British person.
I don't get the reference, so it's probably funny to lots of
people. How to be a good comedy writer, and I just made a joke my audience couldn't possibly understand. But do as I say, not as I do.
There you go. I would be remiss in not asking you this question. I'm really sorry. We have a guy on our group called Bobo. He does this pod called Crisis in Toyverse, and he would kill me if I did not ask about your Star Wars figures in the background there. I'm looking at them. Have you put them in release date order?
Release date order? No. They're this is kind of a compromise of release date, order of appearance, and order of importance. Behind me is a complete collection of vintage Star Wars action figures, including 13 custom figures that are the figures that I think like should have been released. I see that my reflection in the window is blocking it, and I'm afraid to move.
It's fine. A good 7/8 of it's there. There's no way Bespin Han Solo should be further below Boba Fett. No way. Bespin Han Solo needs to be higher than Boba Fett. I mean, Boba Fett goes out like a bitch in Jedi.
Oh, well, like I said, it's order of appearance, order of importance, and order of release. It's like a compromise of those three. So after Von Bock, by the way, everybody. Bye,
I'm going to do that next, don't worry.
After the Bounty Hunters, then we go to all the Bespin versions of the characters, roughly in order of importance, because Luke Skywalker is always first. But it coming up with this order took me a long time. I'm not going to change it now.
All right, okay, fair enough.
On my face, if you go to my Facebook page, I'll make it public. I have like nice close-up shots of. And this is a cabinet made by a guy named Charlie Peterson who makes toy cabinets. This is specifically designed to hold the complete collection of Star Wars action figures. Apparently, there's several people in the world who have this cabinet if they have the complete collection. There's 13 extra spots because it's designed to have all the variants, like plastic cape Jawa and Egghead Han Solo and that stuff. And I was interested in that, so that's why I got the 13 custom made ones, including Uncle Owen, which being named Owen, that is key.
Oh, very good, very good. All right, excellent. Thank you for the digression. So, where can people get their hands on Von Bock?
Go to hammercomics.com, HAMMER-COMICS. And if you own Hammer Comics without a dash, sorry, I was so threatening earlier. Please come talk to me. You can buy the individual issues there at the storefront. You can go to Amazon Comixology. It's all under the name Von Bock, under Hammer Comics, whatever. Issues 1 through 3 are on sale on Comixology. Issues 1 through 4 are available at the Hammer Comics storefront. I'm looking into other distributors. I'm looking into a print edition. All I can tell you for sure is that once all 7 issues are done, I'm going to release it as a graphic novel. And there will be a print edition of the graphic novel. Whether there's print edition of the individual issues is something I'm trying to work out, because there's no point in doing it if I lose money.
Totally fine. Totally get that. That's cool. Excellent. So there you go, guys. Von Bock. There you go. Horror book with a humor twist from Owen Hammer. Visual creator. God in one movie. creator, writer of this fantastic book. Go check it out. We will be doing a segment on this on our next Flipside Focus podcast, because that's how much I love this book. So go and check that out in a couple of weeks. Owen, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for spending time.
Great to be here. Thank you, everybody.
You're welcome. Guys, all that's left for me to do is say, sorry, Owen, go for it.
Be safe. The pandemic is still happening.
It is indeed. Indeed. So it's, what is it? What would you say these? Wash your hands, cover your face, watch your space. That's it. That's your motto. So don't forget to check out the UCPN for all your favorite podcasts, including Crisis of Toyverse, now that we've talked about it, and the Star Wars figures are there. Flipside Focus for the indie books, and of course, The Definitive Crusade, where we talk everything DC. This is Joining the Machine Hughes. Once again,
saying, Owen the Hammer.
Adios.
Adios.
Visit UndercoverCapes.com for the latest and greatest podcasts via the Undercover Capes Podcast Network. Also visit our parent company website, ComicCrusaders.com, all about comic pop culture.